You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Brad and Julia Ryu, the authors, the co-authors of the new Asian-inspired fantasy novel, The Last Tiger. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by you, our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as a Patreon supporter, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server where we can chat with us about our book club picks in real time. And if you join at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast Boba Chats, as well as the ability to help us pick a book club pick once per quarter.
Yeah, so Brad and Julia, they're the co-authors of The Last Tiger, and it is a YA fantasy that is set in a colonized land where tigers are being hunted to extinction. And two star-crossed teens from opposite classes, opposite worlds, join forces to try and reshape their destinies. There's a bit of romance, there's a lot of action, there's a bunch of magic. And for someone who really loved Korean folktales and Korean history, this was definitely my jam. And I was so excited to talk to Julia and Brad about their debut book.
Yeah, so without further ado, here is our author chat with Brad and Julia.
And we are here with Julia and Brad Ryu, the co-authors of the YA fantasy, The Last Tiger. Julia is a composer, lyricist, and librettist who is best known for her viral hit Dive, a reimagining of the Korean folktale Simcheong, and is now being developed for the stage. And her brother, Brad, is an MFA candidate in fiction at NYU's creative writing program, and he won the Ecker Short Story Prize. Welcome to the show, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
So good to be here.
So this is our first time having co-authors on the show. So this is like a new dynamic. We'll see how it works. but I like to start off our episodes with a little icebreaker. But before we get into that, have you watched K-pop Demon Hunters?
Of course. Well, Brad hasn't, but I've shown him all the songs.
Brad,
I actually haven't seen it yet, but I've got some of the tunes stuck in my head.
I've shown him every single song.
This is great because my icebreaker question for you guys was, what is your favorite song from the K-pop Demon Hunters OST?
Oh my gosh. It totally depends on what mood I'm in, I think. Because like, if I'm feeling kind of like... Like, I think Your Idol is such a fun bop. But also, that's not the song that's playing in my head all day. The song that's playing in my head all day is either Golden or Soda Pop. And probably yeah. Soda, like I'm always singing Soda Pop, but I don't think that's my favorite one. But it's in my head the most.
I got to second that. That's the one Julia's been showing me a few times. And so that's stuck in my head. But I got to see the movie. Everybody's been telling
times.
Me about
Did
it.
Did I show you Soda Pop really more than once?
I think it was, yeah, one or two times.
Oh my God. It's so catchy. I can't get it out of my head.
I've seen it twice now, but like for my third time, I'm saving it to watch it in Korean and see like how the voice acting is.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I heard that An Hyo-seop is like, you know, he reprises his role. Same thing with Lee Young-hoon, who reprises Klima. So I'm like, okay, I want to see like how the acting delivery is.
Oh, that's but, so interesting.
Personally, I am a Golden girl, and Soda Pop is definitely one of those songs that I'll just like sing when there's an awkward silence. It's just like to fill the noise.
That's so true. I also do that. Unintentionally.
What about you, Marvin? I know you've watched it. You've watched it for good pop.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be Golden just because there's a bridge in that song that reminds me of an old, I think it was a Tiny Toon sketch that uses kind of a similar like da, 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 and that just stuck in my head. That's that like little snippet has just been stuck in my head. It's terrible.
What's really funny is like when I first like heard the songs, like first off, like I heard Your Idol and like Soda Pop first. Like I listened to the boy groups first before I watched the movie, and I was like, Kevin Wu from UKISS? Andrew Che? Like I haven't heard him since like K-pop season 2. Like what are they doing? So it's just been like really fun to see like all these Korean diasporans like come out of the woodwork, whether it's like in K-pop or writing and directing. So it's a great time for us Korean diasporans. Like our culture is like really in the spotlight right now.
Totally.
Which we'll probably cover later on in our discussion.
Yeah. Also great time. The Last Tiger, written by you two, which just came out as on the week that we're recording. It just came out. So congratulations on your book launch. Hopefully
thank
that's going
so
well
much.
For you guys.
Yeah, thank no, you, thank you. Thank you so much. We're so excited.
Yeah. All right. So we like to start off our, as an Asian American book club podcast, we like to ask our, you know, our authors, you know, to tell us a little bit about their journey to becoming a novelist, and especially you two as siblings who are both in creative fields. Like I would love to hear like your, whether it's your individual journeys or also your combined journeys, like, and how you got to come together to write a book together.
And totally. Which one was the creative writer first and the other one like copied them?
That's a great question. I think we've always both been creative from the start. Julia, do you want to maybe start with your journey?
Brad was born first, so maybe I guess by that he was the first. But I do think that we definitely have, I mean, as Brad and I grew up playing storytelling games all the time. That was, we always would play together. And we actually have another brother who's in med school now. He's getting his MD, MBA. So he's both med school and business. We kind of took all the creativity artist genes, I guess. But basically, we used to grow up playing together, playing storytelling games. We would like jump up and down and make up stories together. It started when I was like 3 and Brad was, I guess, 7 or 8, he would tell these stories and I'd jump on the bed and then I would kind of fill in and be like, oh, and then this happened and then this happened. So I think we've definitely always been really drawn to stories and storytelling. In terms of my actual career, I grew up really wanting to be a musical theater composer. That was my dream for a really, really long time. And I first started composing, I was actually doing a lot of prose writing up until I was around, 12 or 13 when I really started getting into musical composition. From when I was around like 7 to 13, though, I was doing a lot of everything. And then when I was in high school, Brad and I actually wrote a musical together. And that was one of the first musicals that I've ever written. And, I went into college specifically, wanting to be a theater and music concentrator, got to my first semester at Harvard, and by Thanksgiving I had switched into pre-med. And there were many reasons behind why I switched, but I think the primary reason was sort of this lack of visibility. I didn't know a single Asian person who worked in theater at the time. And I also didn't know a single woman who was a musical theater writer or a composer. And so in my mind, when I looked at the successful Asian American women that I knew, they were all doctors. And so I thought, well, I want to be successful, so I think I'll be a doctor. Kind of not realizing that my logic may have been flawed. And then my sophomore year, I founded a club at school for the, it was, it's called ASAP. It's the Asian Student Arts Project, which basically is a group in service and in support of Asian students to make art inspired by Asian themes. And I wrote this show called The East Side for our first musical that we put on. And that ended up opening up a lot of opportunities for me. I ended up getting noticed by a local theater, the American Repertory Theater, who then started commissioning me to write some musicals for them. I started getting really close with the people who worked at ART. And by my junior year, I switched back into I newly felt confident in becoming a writer, now that I had sort of this community that we had, a lot of our mission was, you know, creating more Asian artists. And so I had felt very isolated my freshman fall, but over the years our club grew and grew. And so then I was very full force into being a writer. By senior spring, I'd written, I think, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 musicals. And I got signed by my agent my senior spring. That's when I also made the deal with the American Repertory Theater to develop Dive, my musical. And but between that, between junior and senior year, I took a gap year, and that was when I was home for the pandemic, and that's when Brad and I actually started writing The Last Tiger. So in terms of my artist journey, that's how I became a fully fledged artist. There's much more story involved in terms of like the time that I was writing prose, went away from it and came back to it. But I'll let Brad take it.
Yeah, what about you,
Brad?
Yeah, no, I mean, being siblings, I think there's some similar themes in our stories. I had always been thinking back and forth between whether I wanted to go down more of a science path or an arts and literature path. I had always had a childhood dream of wanting to be a writer, but I was probably more firmly on the path to be a clinical psychologist I graduated with a psych degree and then ended up in working in the mental health care in the nonprofit sector after graduating college. And then it was during the pandemic when I came down with a series of health challenges. I had first like a serious mold allergy and then a COVID infection. And I came down with chronic fatigue syndrome and got fired from my job. Couldn't keep working, tried to go back to work a few times and ended up having a lot of time on my hands. And one of the things that spun out of that was the chance to write a book. I'd always wanted to do that. I also was able to go back to school part time and get a fiction a MFA, creative writing at NYU. Over the past few years, writing with a chronic illness has been its own whole set of challenges, but it's been a lot of fun to get to work with Julia to get this book out. It's been a couple years in the making, and we're so excited it's finally here.
Wow, that sounds, it sounds like you had a lot on your plate, and writing with chronic illness, it's like you said, it's a challenge. And I'm curious as to hearing challenges as like a writing duo, like, are there any egos clashing? Is like one of you better at editing than the other? Do you guys split chapters? I'm very curious to like know how you guys work.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody asks this question because I think everyone's very curious about it. I think one of the really great things about working with a sibling is that we have this really strong trust between us. So if you might, in other projects or other collaborations, have to deal with someone's ego or any of that, that really hasn't been present in our collaboration. We can kind of be very blunt with each other if we have disagreements. And but I think one of the things I really enjoy about working with Julia is just how good she is. She's incredibly talented and has a really good sense of judgment for storytelling and character and all of the things that go into making a book great or any storytelling venture. And so it's just a ton of fun to get to work with her and spend a lot of time with her.
Oh, thanks. I totally agree. Like Brad and I are just very, very, there's no sense of sugarcoating anything. I think we can be, because we really do trust in each other's judgment. Likewise, for me, ever since I've been writing, Brad is always my number one person that I ask for storytelling help. He's my dramaturg on all my musicals. And I always, whenever I get stuck with a plot problem, I always go to Brad first. And so I think that really helps. And Jet, I honestly don't think there are any downsides, because everything is just easier with two. I think, first of all, I always feel like two brains is better than one brain. Two perspectives is deeper and richer than one perspective. And then on top of that, there's a passage you don't feel like writing, you can say, hey, can you write it? And then, I'll work on it later. I think it's funny because Brad really loves the editing process, and I really love sort of like the idea inspo throwing things at the board process. And so that works really well as well, where we can kind of take the passages and take the things that we're most interested in tackling. And then we did this process where we basically would write the first draft of whatever we were most interested in, and then we'd pass it off to the other person. The other person would write in there and then pass it off again. And I honestly don't think you could do that with someone that's not your sibling or someone that you're just really, really close to, because we would literally be changing words in each other's sentences without asking, but with the shared agreement that we have a shared taste and we have a shared sense of trust. And you know, we're not going to be offended of like, why'd you delete that sentence? Because we just kind of give each other the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I mean, like looking at the pros, it seems really seamless. It feels like one person, one brain wrote it. So I really commend you guys on your teamwork. I am curious, since your book is split into two POVs, so you have Song and you have Eunji, was there a character that like each of you guys like felt more like you had a grasp on than the other?
Well, it's kind of interesting because when we designed the story, we came up with, I think Brad and I are really, we're planners. So we'll come up with the entire story. We'll flesh out the characters. We want to know who are these people inside and out before we go ahead and write the story. So I feel like we actually have, I remember there was a point in the writing process where we were like, these people feel real to us. And we really cared about them really, really strongly. When we first started writing, Brad initially was taking the Song chapters and I was initially taking the Eunji chapters on our very, very early draft. But by chapter 8, that went away. And in the final draft, it's not like that at all. The final draft, we really both worked on both characters pretty equally. And in every sentence, like both of us have tinkered with every single sentence in the book.
Yeah, it definitely shows. It, like I said, it's very seamless. It feels like one person wrote it. And yeah, it's like really interesting that you guys like worked on both POVs and, you know, like there was no egos and you guys just like handed off like chapters to each other with ultimate trust. So like you mentioned in your foreword that you know, this book was partially inspired by your grandparents' story, their love story. Can you tell us a little bit about like their romance and how it influenced you as writers for the story?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so we, you know, our grandparents were always around when we were growing up. They lived pretty close by in St. Louis, to where we were growing up, and they would always tell us stories kind of offhandedly over dinner or if they would come over to the house. I think we were always kind of in awe of the lives that they'd lived. I think like many immigrant grandparents, they came from a world that seemed like very far away from the world we were growing up in and full of adventure and hardship. I remember hearing stories about like the Korean War or other things that they'd gone through and just being kind of amazed at the ordinary way that they would talk about these life and death situations that they'd survived or the extraordinary challenges that they lived in their lives. Those stories we were always thinking about. I'd done some interviews with our grandfather when I was in high school. And then later we started to think about whether we could do something with them after our grandfather passed away. So in the beginning of the pandemic, he was one of many of that early wave of COVID deaths in 2020. After he died, our grandmother ended up writing down almost 50 pages of this like really heartfelt, wrenching, beautiful story of their lives together and the things that they'd gone through. And it was so beautiful and so moving that I think Julia and I knew right away that we wanted to do something with it. We weren't sure exactly what, but they, you know, they met in the time when Korea was a colony of Japan, back when the Korean language was outlawed, Korean customs were outlawed. There was a state policy was to try to assimilate Korea into the Japanese Empire. And then they lived our grandfather ended up, he was pretty poor. His dad had died when he was young, leaving him the sole breadwinner for a large family. While our grandmother was wealthy, her parents didn't want them to get together, so they would kind of sneak out or they would pass love letters between intermediaries. there's so many stories to tell, but we ended up sort of going back and forth and deciding a young adult fantasy novel would be an accessible and a whimsical, fun way to tell some of these hefty themes of the stories they'd gone through.
Yeah, I mean, going from your grandmother's memoir to YA fantasy with like magical powers, I was like, that is quite a leap. Did you guys like? I don't know, like, what were your initial feelings about that? It's like, oh, dude, like, should we? Like, were there any hesitations about it?
Honestly, I think we were just really excited to share their story. And to me, the genre that I've always worked in for, I mean, not always, but a lot of the genre that I work in is fantasy. Musical theater in particular is a lot of adaptation. Most musicals are adaptations of something. And a lot of my work in musical theater, my early work in musical theater was in fantasy and folklore adaptation. And I think knowing that we wanted this story to be for young people, we were also young people writing it. I think that fantasy is just a space that has always really spoke to us. Brad and I also grew up reading fantasy, watching fantasy, loving, you know, fantasy and sci-fi. And I also think that fantasy has a particular one special thing about it is that when you're creating your own world, you can make that space whatever you want culturally and say whatever you want, what your message that you want to say. So for us as Korean Americans who grew up only in America, in our household, we grew up speaking English only. And a lot of our culture is truly, it's Korean American. And there is no sort of it's just to be able to authentically represent our true culture. The only way that we can do that also in this time period is by creating a world of our own. And so creating a fantasy space, I think, is the best way was what made the most sense. And I also think that like often maybe people write off fantasy as being something that is maybe silly or is like not worthwhile, not a deeply impactful genre. But I actually think that especially for young people, so many of the lessons that we learn and so many of the, I think the ways that we learn to imagine other worlds and the ways that we learn to imagine what it's like to step into the footsteps of someone else living in such a different world is by consuming fiction that is whimsical and fun and also carries these really dark and deep and intense themes. So I think we didn't have any hesitations there. We were just kind of excited to share this story in a new form.
No, that's really great to hear because I feel like so many people in Asian American diaspora, like there's like this imposter syndrome. They're like, oh, can we take our culture and like make it into fantasy? Can we take our family's history and make it into something that, you know, is not like a memoir? And like this is like so funny because I was like scrolling through Instagram before this interview and I came across Ellen O's most recent post. Ellen O is one of the founders of We Need Diverse Books and she's also an author. And like the post was about white authors wanting to write their own K-pop demon hunters inspired.
I think I saw
books.
That. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just been like a hot topic in like the book sphere on social media these days. I'm just curious to hear your take. Like, what are your thoughts on like people outside of this community writing novels that are centered on Korean culture and also folklore? Because it's not just pop culture, you know,
right.
Like K-pop Demon Hunters is very rooted in Korean folklore mm-hmm. and shamanism and all of that. Mm-hmm.
So I want to say my gut instinct is that it does require some kind of deep roots into a culture to draw on it. But I think there are two counterexamples that are really interesting to us. One is Avatar: The Last Airbender, which I think has been really meaningful to Asian American audiences who are growing up. And I think it's evident from that story how deep the research was that they did and that how deeply rooted the story is in the cultures that it came from. I think even though it was written by two white guys, It was so, I think, so emotionally invested in and steeped in the cultures that it was drawing from, that it was a show that I think all of us saw, or all of us who saw it growing up were really moved by. In fiction, I think there's an adult fiction novel, The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson, another white man who is interested in writing about North Korea. And if you read it, it's clear that he's not Korean. It's clear that what he's writing about is not North Korea, but there's this, the novel is just so good that I almost tend to put it in a third space in my head, where it's clearly something about that project is problematic. And I'm not sure if the book shouldn't exist, but the fact that it does, I think, is something that I chew on, because it was, when I came out, one of my favorite books for just how thrilling and well done it was, even though it was clearly about some white imaginary of North Korea rather than about something North Korean itself. I think we also have you alluded to the sense of imposter syndrome around whether these cultures really belong to us, given that we didn't grow up in them. We grew up with sort of this like echo of an echo of them. And the act of re-establishing a relationship, or in some ways, I would almost say appropriating the cultures that we originally come from into our own lives. I think there's an example of a really complicated. So we didn't learn that the Korean concept of Han until pretty late in the drafting process. So Han, for listeners who don't know, is this. It was a very popular concept in Korean culture maybe 20, 30 years ago that was people thought would explain a lot about the Korean psyche. It's the idea of this collective grief that we feel based on the historical anguishes and hardships, adversity that we've survived. This concept had always been really meaningful to us as a way of understanding the traumatic experience, the adversity that our grandparents had gone through, and then to learn later in the drafting process, we learned that somebody sent us an article, and then Julia's fiance pointed out that this term has actually been critiqued in Korean culture recently. There's been we were reminded that Han was actually originated by a Japanese person. Exactly. Yeah. And
like he wrote a thing about like the beauty of sorrow, and people had thoughts about it even back then in like the 1920s.
Yeah, but it's really interesting, because in recent years, like I think Korean Americans in particular have really taken and reclaimed that the meaning of Han, and it's been especially in Korean American media, a reclamation of the term, to the point that Brad and I had only known the sort of the unity and the positive parts of it that resonated with Korean Americans. So then to learn that in Korea people think very, very differently about the concept of Han, I think that's like a great example of something that we as diasporic authors had to contend with much later in the process.
Like, can I just say, like, when I read books, I take off the dust jacket before I start reading. And I was just so happy that I saw this. Like, people can't see it on the podcast, but when you take off the dust jacket of the first edition of The Last Tiger, the words Chong, Nunchi, and Han are written in Korean. It's written in Hangul. And those are the three main parts in your book. Your book is divided into those three parts. And I was like, wow, these are such unique Korean traits. And I wonder if non-Korean readers are going to like actually get it because they're so Korean. Can you like give us a rundown on like what these traits mean to our listeners, and also like why did you decide to center your book on these three very specific traits?
Totally. Well, to answer the second part of the question first, so much of this book is about finding pride for Korean culture. And I think that's actually one aspect that we as Korean Americans put our own personal experience into. A lot of this book is about how do you find that hope and that pride when you've been told your entire life that you may be lesser or that you might, you know, deserve to be replaced or changed. And so including these really palpable elements of Korean culture in the book was really, really important to us, especially the parts that we felt really spoke to us. And then in terms of the choice of the words, we really wanted to choose words that were first uniquely associated with Korean culture in a way that would encapsulate that feeling that we were trying to evoke. And secondly, that describe, that kind of encapsulate the part of the book that it's about. So Cheong, which is part one of the book, is sort of, I mean, one of the fun things about these words is that there's no direct translation in English. But the way that we describe Cheong is kind of like an affection between two people that grows over time. And part one of our book is when our two protagonists meet and their bond deepens over time. And then part two of the book is Nunchi. And in our fantasy reimagining, one of the magical powers in this world that is given to specifically the tiger people who represent the Korean people in our book is the power of Nunchi, which is often considered like a Korean, some people call it Korean superpower, but it's really, it kind of, some people say it's emotional EQ. Some people say it's the ability to know what to say or how to say something or how to respond without having to be told. There's also the, some people say it's the ability to understand other people's emotions inherently and to read the room kind of. And we've sort of magicalized that in part two of our book as this form of a superpower, essentially, which is the power to communicate and transfer and feel other people's emotions and memories. And then the third part, Han, which we've already touched on a bit. Han is often kind of considered this collective shared grief and suffering that the Korean people feel, and sadness over the difficult history that we have experienced. And if you read the book, you can see how that's relevant in part three. Yeah.
Yeah, like Nunchi is definitely something that I've heard as like a superpower among Koreans, but to me as a Korean American, it's just stress. Okay, it is just societal pressure to conform and to just take notice of things before you get picked out because you're like standing out. But you know, different definition really for people who are part of the diaspora, like different lived experiences and all that. So you mentioned like Nunchi as like one of the powers that like the tiger people have. And I thought it was really interesting that you had different nations with different powers. Can you kind of go into like where you came up with the magic system?
Yeah, for sure. So I think when we were thinking about, you know, ki is this Korean concept that comes from the Chinese word qi, which refers to the energy that flows through the world and flows through your body. It's a Taoist concept, but in our usage of it here, we were really thinking about qi as a metaphor for culture, the power of culture as it moves through people and society. And when we were thinking about each of these three cultures and the ways in which our characters and the ways in which what culture meant to them and the ways in which they manifest a culture in their lives, when we think of for example the Korean powers, the Korean superpower we often think of as being this a deep emotional center based on the experiences that we've gone through. In the story, we would think about the Dragon Empire as having this power of strength. They're in the book. They're the the powers authority that's coming in from the outside to take over, and they seem like this awesome force that is unapproachable. And so we wanted to sort of physically give them something that seemed awesome and fearful in that way. And brute strength seemed like a clear way to do that. And then when it comes to the serpent powers manifest in the character of Jin, who is this Korean rebel who has earlier in her life been completely robbed of agency over her own life, has sort of retaken power into her own hands. And we thought it might be interesting to literally give her power. She has this power to control other people with her words to take someone who had been at one point completely powerless and to give them total power over others, we thought was a really interesting shift. So each of these concepts, I think, was serving a particular function in the book. Julia, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
No, exactly.
Yeah, it's a very unique magic system. And I was like, oh, okay. I was just like wondering, like, how each one got assigned to each country, but after hearing your answer, I kind of like get it now.
Yeah, I was also wondering, because the Serpent Nation in your book, that's China, right? That's the old imperial hegemony, and I can kind of see like the mind control, because China's a very bureaucratic state, so maybe like, you know, a place where words and, you know, indirect power have power over the masses. That does make a little bit of sense.
Yeah, and Koreans are known to be very dramatic, very angry. So that makes sense. So the title of your book is called The Last Tiger. And obviously tigers are a big thing in your book and also in Korean history. I mean, it might be news to some listeners, but like Korea used to have a lot of tigers, to a point where there is a Chinese proverb that says Koreans hunt tigers half of the year and tigers hunt people the other half of the year. That's how many tigers there were in Korea at the time, even the southern part of the peninsula. And even before the Japanese came, we had like imperial tiger hunting squads. So it is very deep in our culture. So like, can you share like what the tiger's significance is in your fictional universe?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a fact that I learned not too long before we started writing this book. Just a friend had offhandedly mentioned to me that during the Japanese colonial period, the Japanese government targeted the Korean tiger for extinction, and they were successful. So they basically, as a matter of state policy, they went out and killed all of the tigers in Korea. The tiger was the national animal. And it was a symbol of Korean culture. And it was really just this like visceral and almost unnecessarily cruel way to demonstrate their project, right? They're at the time, they really wanted to assimilate the Korean peninsula into Japanese culture and the Japanese empire and to eradicate the Korean culture. And so we thought it was a really powerful symbol to focus the nature of this time and sort of everything that was wrapped up in the what Korean culture means to us in this symbol of the tiger. So we've reimagined in the book, we've reimagined the tiger as this mythical spirit that is the source of the powers that they give to Koreans. And ultimately the deepest power that they unlock is this emotional and a historical memory that they're able to pass down from one person to another. So I think it's one of the beautiful ways that fantasy can really make something that's true come to life in a way that it is even more extraordinary than you might be able to do in any other genre. And it was a lot of fun to get it to do it that way.
Yeah, and like tigers in Korean Korean literature, they don't actually have like the best reputations either. They're kind of seen as like dumb people. Like they're always like tricked by humans, or they face like they face like death in like the cruelest ways because they were stupid. So to have tigers be majestic and powerful in your story, I was like, yeah, like that seems way cooler than a tiger that, you know, thinks that a dried persimmon is like a bomb or something. So
or falls off a ladder to its death or something, right?
Yeah.
But that would have been super fun too. I'd love to see the other version of it, which the tiger is a sort of comedic buffoon.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why like the Derpy Tiger is like so popular right now, because the Derpy Tiger from K-pop Demon Hunters is actually based on a real Derpy Tiger in Korean fine arts, the Minhwas. And it's like, yeah, like tigers in general were seen as like jokes, like comical narrative and commentary pieces. So
yeah, like you know, my local Korean coffee shop is called Smoking Tiger, and I'll have way more context on why it's called that.
Like speaking of tigers, your book mentions like the myth of Tangun and the story of the tiger and bear and like their mission to become human. They're told to only eat garlic and mugwort for 100 days, and then they'll be turned into humans. The tiger gives up, and the bear succeeds and turns into like the first woman in Korea, who then gives birth to like the first real ruler of Korea, Tangun. And I just thought it was interesting that Eunji, your lead female character, saw the bear woman's obedience and endurance more as a fault than a virtue. And I had like never seen that interpretation of that myth. And I'm curious, like, can you talk more about how women, especially women who wielded Dragon Key, how they navigated your world in the book?
It's a really good question, because it actually transformed over the process of writing the book. It's an interesting thing, because when you build a fantasy world, you have the power to, you know, you can make that world whatever you want. That world could be a world that doesn't face sexism or racism and these certain things. But we also wanted to contend with things that, themes that we were interested in exploring, and themes that our grandparents and our ancestors and us ourselves had personally faced. And I think something that I really just kind of enjoy, in general, as someone who really loves mythology and folklore, is looking back at our old folklore, our old mythology from all over the world, and thinking about what has changed in our modern world, and are these stories relevant to us anymore, and what can we take from these stories, and what can we look at these stories to then observe, oh, this is kind of an interesting form of thought. And so I think when I thought about that folktale, I had always heard that folktale and sort of, you know, the way that obedience and persistence is really the great strength of that story. But I also think we don't even provide an answer in the book, but it's really a question when Eunji thinks for the first time, well, did that tiger who ventured out, did the bear who remained, did she have aspirations beyond just becoming a mother and a mother of the, because ultimately, how does she get rewarded? Well, she doesn't become the ruler of the new kingdom. She becomes the mother and the wife, and that's really her place. And I think it just says something really interesting about when that story first originated, maybe the context in which how women were thought of in that time. I mean, this is a little bit tangential, but I had this experience recently where I went traveling with my fiance. We've visited a couple different countries, and it was really sort of shocking to me to go around the world and visit these landmarks. Like, we would go to temples, or we would go visit, you know, an old cathedral, and you look at all the paintings, and women, unless they are something like the Virgin Mary, like unless they are someone's mother or a fictional angel, they are completely absent from folklore, mythology, and narrative, unless they are serving some purpose of being a mother. And so I just found that to be really interesting. And that really got me thinking about this the folktales that we tell and the folktales that we pass down and the way that women are represented in these old, old stories. And rather than providing an answer, I just really wanted to ask the question of like, oh, is there another way to look at these stories? Like, how are we thinking of these stories? So in our novel, it's interesting because Eunji is actually in a particularly traditional family. We had an original version of the novel where she was actually the first girl ever to have Tiger Ki, but we thought it might be more, it might resonate a little bit harder and feel a little bit more correct to our own experiences if she came or our grandmother's experience if we put her in a family that was just particularly traditional. Our grandmother was literally put under house arrest when she refused to marry the guy that her parents wanted her to marry, and so we then transfer that to Eunji. Eunji is truly confined to her home until she agrees to marry whoever they want her to marry. And so, yeah, I think there's just a lot to unpack when we look at old folklore, and mythology is so fun. But I think it's also really important to sort of look at them from the new perspective and different angles that we have today.
Yeah, definitely. I just think it's really ironic that Eunji, like, after she goes through her academy training and gets, like, the dragon key, I'm like, you have super strength. You have so much power. You can beat the system. But really, that's the question. Like, is the system really working to her benefit? And this is, like, a question that she grapples with the rest of the novel. And I just want to hear your thoughts on like how you like made the empire in the book and how like you made the system particularly like broken with like the exams for the school. Like, how did you come up with all of that when you were developing your book?
How did we come up with all that?
You know, I think when I think a lot about what we tried to include in this book is a range of intersectionalities and different types of everything on the spectrum of privilege, from having absolute power. We have the governor general figure who is this dominating authority over this entire people, to absolutely powerless. Including lots of different characters who have different complexities in their experience. I think, Marion, in many ways, when we look back on this history, we often see ourselves in the mirror. So I think we were using the template of history to think through a lot of questions we'd been experiencing in our own lives around gender and race in the society we're growing up in right now.
And I know that class as well,
and class, yeah, and these two characters are both wrestling with trying, like we all are wrestling with trying to find their own destiny in a system that seems hell bent on depriving them of that, and I think we both have wrestled with those questions in our own lives, in growing up in a male dominated, white dominated society, in the richest country on the planet, or in the history of the planet, but which has surprising and insulting to human dignity, the inequalities that are here, and the inadequacies of the system to take care of the basic needs of Americans. And I think, you know, for Sung, I want to say a lot of my own experiences struggling with race in this context were put into his experience. You know, there are certain ways in which he gives sort of all his effort and into trying to rise through the system as as he sees those opportunities available to him, but stumbles against how opportunities are not always available in there isn't always a pathway that you can climb. Some fields are less restricted than others, obviously. So there are different parts of society are easier to get into, or the bamboo ceiling can really tighten in other fields. He struggles with sort of when you don't see a pathway through, how to find the motivation to keep trying. Song is someone who has to sort of step back from the path he imagined for himself and then reimagine his place in his relationship, I think, with the society around him and with the system as it's set up, and ultimately comes through with his own experience to try and transform first himself and then just to bring that the new energy that he has into the world. And then Eunji as a character had her own sort of complex journey that Julia, I don't know if you want to go more into it or.
Yeah, I mean, I think I talked a lot about it in the last question, but the system is, you know, it's both created in our novel. It's been created both to reflect the things that Brad and I are talking about and thinking about, as well as the things that our parents and our grandparents were talking about and thinking about. And then also we wanted to create a world that was accessible for readers and that was fun and you know, magical, where we could also grapple with these issues.
Yeah, I really liked that, you know, both of your characters went through their own like coming of age story, right? Song is, you know, his coming of age is about realizing that the system is rigged, the fallacy of meritocracy, and how to rebel, how to like take charge of your own destiny in the face of like oppression. But I find myself really interested in the Eunji chapters just because like she's such an interesting character because I feel like she has a classic Asian American coming of age storyline where it's about finding the confidence to break away from family expectations, finding independence. But her world also revolves around working within the systems of empire, right? Her family's able to enjoy and maintain their power because they're collaborating with the colonizers. And in a lot of her chapters, I'm like interested to see how she like comes to terms with her own privilege. And I'm really curious if you can tell us a little bit about how you manage to like balance writing like a likable heroine who comes from like such privilege.
I mean, I think it was definitely a struggle to figure out what is her journey, and her journey evolved a lot through each draft. Ultimately, I think we did want to explore exactly, Marvin, as you just said, this very, I think sometimes, you know, we often when we read a fantasy novel, we always expect our protagonist to make the right decision. But I think it's just as interesting often when we watch our protagonist making the wrong decisions. And not even necessarily yet having the ability to grasp why these decisions are wrong when you're just fighting for your life and you're just fighting to be seen. And having to then contend with the fact that you've been in such a flawed mindset. And I think a lot of people, we wanted to present a protagonist to especially a lot of young people who sort of does, I mean, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but you know, who goes along a path and has to contend with the fact that yes, what you were doing was right in your heart, but you had a flawed mindset, and to be able to like rethink that through and to be able to come out on the other side, having learned this. And I think this is a message that we really want young people today to keep in mind. I think sometimes you can be wrong and sometimes you can, you know, learn a lesson. So, I mean, it was definitely a journey of figuring out where Eunji is on her journey and when does each step change? Like, what are the steps of her journey to get her from A to B? And it was fun to explore. And also to try to explore what kind of journey do we need to send her on to take her there? And who are the people that sway her one way or another? And what are the components that sway her one way or another?
Yeah, for me, who is like in her mid-30s, I was like, wow, this is such a young way to look at the world. And like so optimistic. And also you're dreaming so small, you need to dream bigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I am curious to see how your young readers react to Eunji's choices, because as an older reader, I'm like, I was like, oh, child.
Yeah. Totally.
Let's rethink your decisions. But yeah, like we're wrapping up with, like, I could talk forever about your book. That's like how much I loved it. I really wish that I had a book like this when I was a younger reader. Something that is like so rooted in like my culture and also like my history. I was reminded so much of my grandparents and my great grandparents while I was reading this book. And there were some parts where I was like, oh, this is not easy, because a lot of the pain is real. So like, I thank you guys for all the effort and care you guys put into this book.
Thank you so much. That's the dream.
Yeah. Also just fun to read. Such good tension. You have, you know, your main characters who you just want to see together, but the world keeps tearing them apart. You have great action scenes in your book as well. Just all around great fantasy.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you for reading, and thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Okay, so before we go, I know you just launched your book. I'm sure you're busy with like promoting and all that. Are you guys working on anything else, either individually or together?
We have a really fun idea for a science fiction novel. We're thinking an existential science fiction comedy thriller, and stay tuned for more.
Yeah,
I love all those words. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba. Brad and Julia, congrats again on the launch of your book, and yeah,
awesome. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks. Take care.
And that was Brett and Julia Ryu. Their debut novel, The Lost Tiger, is available now at bookstores everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore, where all book purchases support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore as well. So if you'd like to help support, head on over to booksandboba.com and click on the online bookstore link. All right. Before we go, just a quick reminder that our August 2025 book club pick is The Wangs Versus the World by Jay Chang. It is a family comedy about a Taiwanese American family who has fallen on hard times and decide to make a cross-country trip across the U.S. during the 2008 financial crisis. I'm really excited to get into this book with all of you. If you are a Patreon supporter, don't forget to join in on the conversation on Discord. And for those of you who aren't on our Discord, you can also let us know your thoughts on Goodreads as well. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Brad and Julia Ryu for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.